All right, so I am going to ask that if you have a Bible, that you go with me to the very beginning of it in the book of Genesis. Should we sing again now that you're here? We can. When I first told Pastor Carl that I was interested in doing these survey-type studies and especially working through some books, you know, perhaps even doing kind of like we're going to try to do tonight, survey-style type things, he said, well, when you start with Genesis, he said, to get through the whole book of Genesis in a short amount of time, you'll basically have to go with, in the beginning, Joseph died. And we are going to hit both sides of that. That is the way you put it, isn't it? I think it was. So, in a coffin in Egypt. So we are going to hit those two bookends, but we're going to attempt to get to some things in the middle. And I don't have a handout for you tonight. I have some things that'll be on the screen. I won't. I know some of you maybe are the note taking type. So if you there's room on the back of the prayer sheet if you have an ink stick to use to make use of that, if you care to. But I would say, okay, this is just me talking. Don't feel like you have to write all this down. There's not a lot of slides, 5 or 6, but the point is not for this to be like a take home thing for you necessarily. Now, if you find it useful and you're like, oh, I'd like a copy of that, we'll make sure you get it. But the point is not necessarily just to be writing. Rather, I'm hoping to give us kind of a big picture view of things. But sometimes the best way to see the big picture is to look at what details emerge as you go along and survey the kind of canvas the area that way. So there are really only a few different ways that you can I think faithfully understand everything that's in Genesis, the way it's listed there. So one common way is you could understand, and many people have outlined it this way, that about the first 11 chapters of Genesis, so from creation to right before the Abraham saga, is some people have called it something like primeval history. Primeval basically meaning as far back as you can go in recorded history. So 1 through 11 of Genesis is primeval history. And then starting in about chapter 12 with the call of Abraham all the way through 50, there are 50 chapters in Genesis, they would call that something like patriarchal history because you're studying and reading about and learning and seeing the history of the patriarchs, the spiritual forefathers of Israel, as they are told in that in that order. So primeval history, you would kind of subcategorize that probably as basically like creation and then the fall of man and then the flood of Noah. And then at the end of that, you would get like the Tower of Babel and then being dispersed out into the world and the forming of nations coming from that. So those are kind of the key events there in those first 11 chapters. It would have been helpful to have a slide on that, wouldn't it have? I don't have one, so you'll just have to kind of trust me on this, I guess. By the way, let me pause again and say that this is the kind of thing where I appreciate some interaction. So if I give you the chance to respond, it's not rhetorical. I would want your feedback. But also, if you just have something that you want to say or ask as we go through, just please, again, shout at me, put your hand up. That's fine. That's what this is for. So don't be intimidated to do that. That's the first 11 chapters. So when you start into chapter 12 and you talk about the patriarchs, the first one you would read about is Abraham, and then you would get a section on Abraham's son Isaac, and then you would get a section on Isaac's son Jacob. And then you might expect that the last part of Genesis would be focused on Jacob's son, Judah. And Judah is mentioned, and he's semi-prominent and in the background, but actually most of the end of Genesis is not about Judah, from whom is kind of the key line of Israel going forward, but it's actually about who? About Joseph, yeah. So one of the sons of Jacob, but not Judah, so that's interesting. We'll see a little bit of how both of those guys are featured at the end of Genesis as well. So that's the content in a nutshell. So that'd be one way you could summarize the content. The other way, another way that you could summarize the content is by looking at some of these phrases, and we saw a couple of these last week. If you look at, like for example, Genesis 2 and verse 4, you have this phrase, "These are the generations." And then chapter 2, verse 4 there is talking about the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And then you have a similar phrase in chapter 5, verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. And then you could follow that into, I think the next one is in chapter 6, verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. So you have that story laid out. And then I think the next one is in chapter 10. Noah is actually mentioned again in chapter 10, verse 1. These are the generations of the sons of Noah. And then if you look over in chapter 11, verse 10, these are the generations of Shem, being one of the sons of Noah. And then down in chapter 11 and verse 27, now these are the generations of Terah. Terah is the one who fathered Abram. And so you read about the line of Abram. So what's the common phrase that's repeated there? Generations. These are the generations. Now, interestingly, if you read, or as you would read those, normally you're not reading about the one that's mentioned in the line. You're actually reading about what happens after him. So the generations that follow. So when it says like these are the generations of Terah, you're really not reading about Terah. You're reading about his sons, his line, his family line after him. But there are 10 times in Genesis that phrase is found. These are the generations. And so you could do a tenfold division of Genesis that way and outline it that way, going on down really through the end. I'm not as interested in going through, at least in any sort of thorough way, all of those, really either of those kinds of structures. What I want to do instead is kind of just start in chapters 1 and 2 and show you how some of the key themes that play themselves out in the rest of the book are foundational in the creation passage. And then there's a structure, especially in Genesis 3, that is key to what not only to what happens there, but what would come out of the fall in Genesis 3. And then that same kind of structure is repeated on a bigger scale in the rest of the book. So that's confusing enough. We'll show you. I'll try to show you, not just tell you, as we go along. Look with me at chapter Genesis 1 and verse 2. So we know Genesis 1:1, beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, the earth was without form and void, is the way that I'm reading from ESV here. Formless and empty would be some of the other ways it's translated. I don't know what, does anybody have something different than that? The ideas are the same, obviously. Basically, it means there's no shape to it and there's nothing in it, right? It's formless. And it's vacant. There's nothing there. Well, what happens in the creation accounts, especially in days 1 through 3, is you have God forming everything, so taking his creativeness and giving structure to it. So he's creating light and darkness. He's creating the heavens and the seas. He's bringing up the dry land out of the seas so that there is ground and so forth. And then in days 4 through 6, he's filling the void. So he's putting creatures in the seas and in the sky and on the land, and he's putting stars and planetary bodies in the heavens. So even verse 2 sort of gives you the structure. It's formless and empty, So let's form it, and then let's fill the emptiness, is what God essentially does throughout Genesis 1. Go ahead.
Even though it's without, he does refer to it as the earth.
He does.
So that's kind of like, I don't
know. So I made a conclusion one time about this, and I ran this by a friend of mine who is a science teacher who knows things that I don't know about the way that some of this may have worked. But here was my theory, and he thought it could have been a reasonable one. Because also in that verse you have this, the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters before you even read about the creation of waters, right? So what's he hovering over there if there's...
The deep.
The deep, yeah. Yeah.
Still like a nothingness.
Yeah, exactly. So my proposal was, what if in Genesis 1 and 2, you're reading about God creating just matter? Okay, God's creating stuff.
From which he'll make stuff.
From which he then takes that stuff and forms it,
yeah.
And then he speaks things that fill into it. Anyways, he thought that may have been valid. I don't know. But also sometimes the literature will do things like it'll give a broad overview statement and then explain the details, and that also could just be very simply what's happening here. God created the heavens and the earth. That's the summary statement, and then here are the details of the heavens and the earth as they're being created. So either one of those. And they're not mutually exclusive either, probably. Now, so God... does the forming, does the filling, and he does the naming. So look at, for example, at chapter 1 and verse 5, God called the light day and the darkness, he called night. Similarly, down in verse 10, God called the dry land earth and the waters that were gathered together, he called seas. So he's calling things, he's naming things. That's significant for something we'll see later on. Now, What is the primary way in this chapter that God creates? Like, how does he do it?
Speech.
Yeah, just with his words, right? He's just able to say it, and it shows up. So, unfathomable kinds of power. Yeah, before Siri, right? Siri, show me a sun, whatever. Yeah, so he does it with his words, so that's significant. He also, when he creates things, he speaks to some of these things, or at least about some of these things, and you see that down in, starting in like verse 22, chapter 1:22, God blessed them saying, and this is to the creatures that are in the sea and in the sky, saying to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And then there's a similar kind of statement about the land creatures, about how they can reproduce, all these things can reproduce according to their kinds, not just the animals, but even the plant life and so forth. And then we kind of emphasized this, I think, in one of our other talks, maybe even just last week, about the emphasis given on the creation of man. So verse 26, let us make man in our image, and after our likeness. And so I made the case then that to me is indicative of like a father and son relationship. So you see that if you compare Genesis 5, the beginning of Genesis 5, where God made Adam in the likeness of God, but then Adam fathered a son in his own likeness and after his image. So you put those together and you think, okay, if Abraham's fathering a son this way and God creates Adam in this way, it's kind of like God is fathering Adam, which again lines up with things we would see even in the New Testament. So he makes them in his own image, and then he says, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and all the earth and everything that creeps on the earth. So God makes man in this way, and then he tells the man in verse 28, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over, again, the fish of the sea, birds of the heavens, everything that lives and moves on the earth. So there's a kind of ruling that the man can do over the creatures that the creatures can't do among themselves, and so man is given this exalted and glorified position in creation. And all of it is designed to continue and reproduce and grow and fill the land, as it were. And then, of course, at the end of that, in the beginning of chapter 2, God rested from his work. Chapter 2, verse 1, the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done and rested on the seventh day. Now, if chapter 1 is kind of the, we'll say, zoomed out view of creation, so that's just the big, broad overview of what happens, chapter 2 kind of zooms in and doesn't really tell us like the next thing that happened. It really kind of retells us, sort of zooms in on day 6. Well, here's more specifically what happened with the creation of man. And so that's why you read about in verse 7 how the Lord God formed man of the dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And that phrase, breath of life, there in verse 7 matches with even kind of the summary given there in chapter 1 and verse 30, how the beast of the earth, the bird of heavens, and everything that creeps in the earth, everything that has the breath of life. Okay, so those phrases are linked. So we're meant to understand that these things are given the ability, obviously, to live and breathe on their own. Now, there's a difference. So we said with everything in Genesis 1, God made it with his word. What's the difference with how he makes man? Like, does God say, let there be man? Yeah, it's much more intimate, it seems, right? Like, it's almost, I've heard people describe it this way, like, with man, God got his hands dirty. It's like he's digging up in the ground and forming the man, and then, even more intimately, kind of getting face-to-face, mouth-to-mouth with the man, and you have this picture of, as it were, of breathing life directly into him in an intimate kind of way. So man is given this kind of exalted position just by being made in God's image, but then also this seemingly extra care that goes into the creation of man that doesn't go into the creation of other things. And then later in chapter 2, really the next thing there in verse 8, God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And the description of the garden is given there in those verses that follow. And you get this idea, you just get this picture of Eden as this paradise, this place of flourishing and lavishness and no lack of anything, no want of anything, but just this ideal, picturesque land in which God put the man and gave him everything he need. And you even read about this tree, the tree of life that was there, but also this other tree that's mentioned, this tree of the knowledge of good and evil is there. And the one there's really multiple commands that are given, but there's only one prohibition. The command we kind of emphasized last week, one of them at least, from chapter 2, verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. And remember the ideas, if you were here last week, maybe you remember the ideas of work and keep really are to build it out and to guard it. So Adam really has these kind of priestly responsibilities, like expand the borders of the garden. So if you've thought of the whole earth at creation of being like this paradise, I'm really not sure that that's how it was. I think Eden was like a location on the earth, and that in Eden everything was pristine and ideal. But outside of Eden, I don't think it was. I think it was just sort of there, but it wasn't like the garden. And I think that Adam's responsibility then is as it were to like make the borders of the garden expand so that the whole earth becomes the garden. Build it out, expand it, and guard it. Don't let anything unholy come into it. And we talked about how those verbs are used elsewhere in the New Testament to talk about the way that priests also were to build out the tabernacle and guard it and keep anything unholy from coming into it. So there's those priestly connotations there as well. But then the prohibition, of course, comes in the next verse, verse 16. You may eat of every tree in the garden, but not of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day you eat of it, you will surely die. That's the one prohibition. Now, soon as you have those commands, look at the next kind of section there. Look at verse 19 especially. Out of the ground the Lord God had formed every beast of the field and birds of the heavens and brought them to the man. And what was the man's responsibility then? To give them names, okay? Before this, who's the only other one who had given names? God, right? So in chapter 1, we emphasize God called the night, day, and the darkness night. He called the waters, the seas, and the earth, the dry land, and so forth. Well, now here's another indication that God is giving to Adam. Here's another way you can image forth me is by naming things. You have dominion over this. I'm not going to name them. You name them. And whatever Adam called them, that was its name. So Adam gave names. And then you have at the end of Genesis 2, the first wedding, where the creation of woman is described as being brought out of the man. And then the description there at the end of how the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed, which of course is key for what we'll see in the very next chapter. Now, I won't spend as much detail on too many other chapters, but those are obviously foundational for obvious reasons. So I am going to show you something from Genesis 3 here again, because that is such a crucial passage as well. But before I do, any questions or comments so far? All right. Just trying to lay the foundation here. Okay, so let's look now at Genesis 3, and going to, I think, I should turn it on, right? That would help. There we go. Small print, I know. Don't know how well you can read it, but wanted to kind of fit it all up there on the screen. So what you have here is the descriptions of the way the scene in Genesis 3 plays out, and hopefully you can notice from that. I hope you can read it. If not, shame on all of you for sitting way in the back. All right, that's what you get. But notice how all this plays out. You've got the serpent who comes into the garden, and I would argue again that if Adam was given the responsibility to guard the garden, to keep it, to shield out anything that should not have been there, then as soon as the serpent opened his mouth and said, "Did God really say?" Adam should have said, "Absolutely, God said, you can't be in here," and should have, you know, expelled the serpent. But, as it were, the serpent comes in, communicates with the woman who has promised the knowledge of good and evil, who takes and eats with the man who's there with her, and that's when the shame kicks in. That's when we're told that that man and woman realized that they were naked. And what did they seek to do immediately about their nakedness? Cover it up. So they create leaves to do that with. And then you have the man with his wife hiding from God as they hear him walking in the garden. And then God first, obviously, God all-knowing, he knows what happens, but he comes to the man and woman anyway and confronts them. But who does he come to first? The man, what is this you have done? The man is quick to say, "Well, the woman you gave to me took of the fruit and ate it, and then she gave it to me." So then God goes to the woman. What is this you have done? "Well, the serpent whom you made brought this upon us." So then God comes to the serpent, and in one conversation with the serpent, speaks to the serpent. In Genesis 3:14, and he gives a very key phrase. He tells the serpent, "Cursed are you. You are cursed. Above all livestock, above all the beasts of the field, you shall go on your belly and eat dust all the days of your life." And, verse 15, "I will put enmity," this ongoing hostility between you and the woman, "and between your seed and her seed. And he," the seed of the woman, "will bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Now, I suspect, because Adam and Eve would have known, Adam at least would have known, I assume he would have communicated to his wife, what would have happened in the day they ate of the fruit. What did God tell them? In the day you eat of it, you will surely die. Now think about this. When Adam and Eve hear this, hear God, and I assume they heard God speak to the serpent about seed. All right, what does seed mean? They're going to have children. Do they have children yet? No. So I imagine that in Adam and Eve's mind, as God is confronting them, they're thinking, we're going to die. We're going to die. We're going to die. But then they hear your offspring and her offspring. And I suspect maybe they're thinking to themselves, hang on a second. Offspring. We don't have offspring. If we're going to have offspring, we're not going to die yet. So God is merciful even as he is dealing out judgment. In not putting them to death immediately, their death would come later. He's very clear about that just a few verses later. But he's showing them that this plan of his is not going to be thwarted. They will have seed. They will, as it were, be fruitful and multiply and not die immediately. Now, that whole scene plays out the rest of the chapter, but in reverse. So God, even though he had confronted the woman second, he gives her punishment before the man, and then the punishment to the man, and then man names his wife with whom he had hid. He actually gives her the name Eve because, as we're told there in verse 20, she was the mother of all living. It's like her name means life, which, again, they were expecting death. So it's this reversal, something you would not have expected. Whereas the man and woman had tried to cover themselves with leave, God gives them covering with skins, which it's not explicitly said there, but in the reader's mind, you might think, okay, well, if they're covered with skins, something had to die in their place. So a type of sacrifice has taken place on their behalf. Just like the woman was promised the knowledge of good and evil, man now knows good and evil, but he cannot eat from the next tree, the tree of life. And so man is driven out of the garden, and now it is guarded by the cherubim with the flaming sword, whereas before it was completely unguarded. So interesting, kind of very common, but to us, interesting way of sort of telling that story that Moses gives us in that key chapter, with the center point of it, the hinge, the key idea there in the middle being that judgment and yet promise of mercy that's given through what God says to the serpent. So really, with a lot of what we'll see, not only through the rest of Genesis, but really through the rest of the Bible, is that ongoing conflict between the two seeds. The seed of the woman, the offspring of Eve, and the seed of the serpent. So every person that follows in this story and throughout human history belongs to one line or the other, right? So you and I and all people everywhere are either descendants, as it were, from Eve or descendants from the serpent. Now, sometimes there are clearer ways than others to tell who is who and who's on what side, but we'll kind of point some of these out as we go in Genesis so that you can kind of see who's on what side. In fact, it shows up in the very next chapter. Look at the beginning of chapter 4. Adam knew his wife, and she bore, at least at first, how many sons? Two, okay? Notice that of those two sons, they both bring an offering. Abel was a keeper of sheep, Cain a worker of the ground. Now the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So you have one who is accepted and one who is not. What happens to the one son whose offering was accepted? He's put to death, right? He's killed. And because he's put to death by his brother, notice what the Lord tells Cain in chapter 4, verse 11. What does he say to him? And now, Genesis 4:11, you are cursed. Okay, there's only been one other time so far that a creature has been cursed. Who was it?
Serpent.
the serpent. So what do we understand immediately about Cain? He's aligned with the serpent. Cain is the first one that is clearly, essentially said to be a seed of the serpent now. He's cursed in the same way the serpent was. Abel, it seems to be the one son who was accepted or would have been accepted, but now he has died. And so that's why at the end of Genesis 4, you read about Adam knowing his wife again, and so she bore a son and called his name Seth, because God has appointed for me another seed instead of Abel, because Cain killed him. And Seth, that name in Hebrew would sound something like appointed. So God has appointed for me. God has Sethed me a son. I will call him Seth. It would be something like how you could render that. So now you could imagine everyone who knows of this account, who understands themselves to be aligned with the Lord and aligned with the woman. Now, it's kind of like every son that they have, they're sort of wondering, is this the one? Is this the promise? Like, there's a promised seed coming. Is this the one? So you get to chapter 5, and you read about all of these fathers who fathered sons. Their sons lived this and that many years, but then they died. But when he was this many years old, he fathered a son, and that son lived such and such many years, and he died. And on and on, so it's like, okay, well, none of these are the promised seed because they all die. But notice the hope that's there. Like, look at chapter 5 and verse 28. So Genesis 5:28, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah. And Noah is related to a word that would mean something like favor or grace, which is why in chapter 6 you read about Noah found favor, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. His name matches what he found. But anyways, verse 29, called his son's name Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. So it's like Lamech gives, his wife gives birth to this son, he fathers the son, and it's like he's saying, maybe this is the one who will relieve us from our curse. So there's this hopefulness of all the sons that are born, that maybe this is the one. And in a sense, Noah kind of did that, right? Because there's going to be judgment that comes upon not just one individual or even one family, but over the whole world in Noah's day. And Noah is the one who is favored in God's eyes. And so that those who are aligned with Noah, which only apparently is his closest family, they are the ones who again receive mercy, whereas the rest of the world receives judgment. Real quick there in Genesis 6, you see some of these things. Man, Genesis 6:1, man began to multiply. So there's that promise being filled. So it is as though man is being fruitful and multiplying. But as man multiplies, what else is multiplying?
Sin
and wickedness. Such as it's described there in verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. What a summary statement there. But it just indicates that, yes, the earth is being filled with people, but the wickedness is being filled at an even more rapid rate, it seems. So there's this decision that the Lord makes. And it's a decision, I would describe it like it's a decision, okay, he's made everything, now he's going to unmake everything. He's created all things, now because of this wickedness, I will, as it were, uncreate. So there in verse 7, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. So all of those creatures, man and animals, birds and so forth, that are listed there in the creation account, now are listed again in Genesis 6, and it's like, I'm wiping them out. I'm unmaking them. So there's this reversal again that happens. But in Genesis 6, you also have the first time that the word covenant is used, and that becomes a key word in Genesis. So Genesis 6:18, but God speaking to Moses, "But I will establish my covenant with you. You shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you." Now, interestingly, there's a couple different ways that the making of a covenant is described in the Old Testament. There's a word that would basically mean like I'm initiating, okay, I'm starting my covenant with you. But there's another word that would mean something like I'm continuing my covenant with you, okay? And God says both to different people at different times. What do you think he says to Noah? Is he starting one or is he continuing one? Remember, this is the first time it's used. So you would think it would say starting, but it's actually the word for continuing, which you wonder, okay, how is he continuing something that hasn't even mentioned before? Well, I would suggest that God has covenanted, as it were, with Adam. There's a covenant with Adam that's more or less unspoken. It's a little clearer, I think, in some of the prophetic passages, but it's more like God saying to Noah, the promises that I made to Adam, I'm continuing with you. Which is why, when you get to the end of the flood account, in like Genesis 8, and starting in like verse 15, "Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wife, your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So God is telling Noah all of the same things that he already told Adam. So it's really not a new covenant that he's making with Noah. It's a continuation saying, "No," and I think Noah would also understand this, "Noah, you are now to be my new Adam." Something like that. You are to do on the earth what Adam failed to do. Something like that. And that continues on even down into chapter 9. Verse 1, "God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, you be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." And then down in verse 7, it's repeated again. "You be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it." And then explicitly there, starting in chapter 9 and verse 9, "I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you." And so the sign of the covenant about how God would not ever again destroy the earth in that way with a flood. I was reading one commentator on this even earlier today, just kind of reviewing for this, and he said he was reading in a Canadian, he's from Canada, he read in a Canadian newspaper about this political elected official in Canada who once claimed as he got to the end of his elected term that he fulfilled something like 78% of his campaign promises. Like he was boasting about that. 78%. I fulfilled all these, you know, I did like 4/5 of what I promised I would do, and like he was proud of that. Well, I mean, that's like a C in school, right? Or something. But anyways, the comparison that this author made was he's, again, kind of commenting on this passage, he said, when God promises, it's always 100% fulfilled. Because this covenant with Noah has never been broken. The earth has never been flooded in this same way because God fulfills everything that he promises, not just 80%, which I guess if we're being honest, for a politician to even fulfill 80% of what he says is kind of impressive, but not in God's standards. So Noah, as I said, is, I think, sort of viewed as a new Adam. But then notice when you get to the next section there at the end of chapter 9, you read about, starting in verse 18, "The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark, it's from them that all the people of the earth were dispersed." And then verse 20, "Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard." Well, a vineyard is kind of like a garden. So here you have a new Adam in a new garden. Is he going to do any better than the first Adam? Well, keep reading. Verse 21. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. So here you have the new Adam in the new garden who also fails while he's naked. Except this time he shouldn't have been naked in the first place, right? But he then his sons come in, they see his nakedness, and then there's that whole deal of some of them apparently honoring their father in the right way, and then the one not. So then you have the two descriptions of Noah's sons, similar to the way you have descriptions of Adam's sons. So notice in verse 25, back up to verse 24, when Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said what? Cursed be Canaan. So here you have one son of Noah who is cursed. So who is he lined up with? The serpent. And then you have in verses 26 and 27, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant, and may God enlarge Japheth, let him dwell with the tents of Shem, let Canaan be his servant. So yes, more than two sons, but really two judgments, right? One is cursed and one is blessed. You know, one is rejected and the others are accepted, as it were, just as it had been with the sons of Adam. Now, my pace is not good right now. So this is why I knew this would happen. I planned for this. So what I want to do now is to kind of give you some more of these slides and show you how this kind of a structure that you see on a, we'll call it a micro scale in Genesis 3, down to some pretty specific details within a story, actually there's this kind of macro structure, you could call it, in a lot of these episodes that play out in the rest of Genesis. So when you get to the end of the Noah account, as you transition into what happens with Abram, you finish the Noah account with the blessing and cursing given to Noah's sons who would father all the nations, which aligns with seemingly what happens with Abram at the beginning of Genesis 12, where God says to Abram, he who blesses you, I will bless; him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So you have kind of some matching segments there. The line of the sons of Noah, remember, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, that phrase leading to what happens in Babel, where there are many nations, seems to align with Genesis 11, where you read about how Shem's line points down to Abram, and one nation is focused on, all bracketed around that middle account of the Tower of Babel, where the nations as a whole are dispersed. Now, Babel is an interesting account as well, because that's the first time where people obey the command to fill the earth. So why was Babel a bad thing? Well, Babel was a bad thing because here are all the people speaking the same language and assimilating together and saying, look what we can do. Whereas God had said, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, disperse among the face of the whole thing. And so God confuses their language and forces them to do what they should have done obediently in the first place. And then there's this kind of reversal of Babel at Pentecost in Acts 2, where even though a bunch of languages are being spoken, they all can understand in one tongue, in their own tongue, what's being said, and then the question, you know, how can these things be? And then Peter is able to tell them, well, this is what the prophet spoke of. So you have those interesting reversals there as well. There are structures like this throughout a lot of the main sections. So this is, again, where we'll sort of zoom through, not because the details aren't important, but just because I knew we would go more slowly in those initial chapters. But in Abraham's story, you have a similar structure where you start with what happens at the beginning of chapter 12, where God promises to Abram these kind of threefold categories of land. So go out from your country, your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, bless you, and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. We emphasized a lot of this, I know, last week. Again, for those of you that were here, don't expect you to remember all of it, but perhaps by repeating it, it'll kind of remind you that these are promises that, again, would be in some ways an extension of what was given to Adam. Adam had been exiled from the land, from the garden. So here's God promising, I'll bring your people back to a land that is good for them so that the whole world can be blessed. Also, by the way, the punishments given to Adam and Eve seem to kind of match with those three categories. Remember the Lord said, your work on the ground will be hard. Okay, so it's like the land was cursed. You'll have trouble bearing children. Okay, so the seed was hindered there. And then you will die. And where there is death, where there is no life, there is no blessing. So those three categories were affected by the fall. And here's God saying, I'll overcome what happened at the fall, as it were. Abram goes down to Egypt because of famine. It's there he lies about Sarah. Genesis 12 is fascinating because you have, as it were, the chief Israelite going down to Egypt because of a famine. And while he's in Egypt, there's plagues on Pharaoh so that Pharaoh sends him out of his land. So it's like Moses giving clues, hey, this is going to happen again for the whole nation later in its history, where the nation goes down into Egypt because of a famine, but there'll be plagues on Pharaoh, and so that the whole nation will be driven out. Lot is spoken of a couple different places, again, bracketed across from one another. Say Lot inherits Eden, because that's kind of the phraseology given there in Genesis 13. 10, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere like the garden of the Lord. So it's like Lot is, you know, remember, there's Abram's multiplied so much to the point that they can't all fit in the land. So he tells Lot, hey, pick the land you want. And Lot says, well, this looks like paradise. I want to go live there. But then when he gets to paradise, he finds out it's not really paradise at all. He ends up hanging out with the, you know, in the slums of town, so to speak. And he ends up being taken captive by the kings who go to war. And then Abraham has to come and rescue him from the captives of those kings in Genesis 14. So it's like Lot is in the garden, but then falls and has to be rescued in that narrative. And then a couple of different emphasis on the covenant made by God with Abraham and the promise of a son. First, Ishmael is born, but then ultimately the true seed, Isaac, is born. And then again played out in reverse in the chapters that follow, with Lot rescued not by Abram, but by God himself from Sodom as it's destroyed. Genesis 20, Abram lies about Sarah again. And then, finally, the promise of seed to Abraham is given when Isaac is born. But then, in the very next chapter, Abraham, here I am. Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and offer him as a burnt offering for me on the mountain to which I will take you. Abraham obeys, takes his son up the mountain. They travel for 3 days, probably not coincidental. On the third day, it's as though Isaac is raised from the dead, because Hebrews tells us that Abraham, one of the reasons Abraham obeyed, apparently the primary reason Abraham obeyed, according to Hebrews, is because he believed that God could raise Isaac from the dead. And then the author of Hebrews says, which he did in a figural sense. So anytime you see this, you see in Isaac essentially like a death and resurrection type episode. And then those promises that are given in chapter 12 are repeated there in chapter 22 to Abraham in verse 17. I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that's on the seashore. Your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Again, just moving on, kind of showing you the similar structure in similar pattern to what happens with Jacob. You may have noticed there's a little bit of a gap there between 23 through some of 25, not because it's not important, but the structure is just a lot smaller. 23 and 25 match each other because in 23 Sarah dies and in 25 Abraham dies, but in the middle there's a wife for Isaac. So the promise can be continued because Isaac's going to have a wife and he's going to have sons, so then Isaac's sons are born in 25. At the end of that pattern in 35, Isaac's son has a son, has his final son, and then Isaac dies. Again, description of where different people are in the land across from one another. Conflict between Jacob and Esau bracketed across from where Jacob and Esau are restored. Remember, Jacob deceives Esau to the point that Esau says, "I will not rest until I kill my brother." But then the next time they meet each other, Jacob is terrified. "My brother's going to kill me." And he was right in thinking that. But then what does Esau do? He receives him back. Again, an unexpected reversal in the story from what you would expect. The Lord visits Jacob on two different occasions, both through his messenger, bracketed by Jacob's time visiting Laban, where he receives a wife and has many children. There's also this interesting reversal within that story where at first it's Laban who deceives Jacob, like the deceiver gets deceived, you remember? "Hey, work 7 years for my daughter. I'd love to marry Rachel." "Okay." And then, wedding night, it's not Rachel. Work 7 more years. So Jacob is deceived, but then at the end of chapter 31, Jacob gets Laban back, as it were, and deceives. So the deceiver was deceived, who now deceives the other deceiver. It's a pretty interesting turn there in those chapters. And then finally, as you might expect, the same pattern plays out in the story of Joseph. There were too many in Joseph's story to put on one slide, so you have to look at them in back-to-back patterns there. But Joseph's dream about how his sons and his father and mother would honor him, and they laugh, and we would never do that. And then the jealousy and hatred and anger of the brothers to seemingly put Joseph to death, to the point that the father mourns Joseph, who he thinks has died, even though he's not really died. The account of Judah, you may wonder, okay, why is Judah and Tamar, kind of tucked there in the middle of the Joseph narrative? Julie, I told everybody else, if you sat a lot closer, you could see better. And I see you back there trying to... I'm just kidding. Sit wherever you want. But the Judah narrative, again, structurally fits in there, and it sort of gives an account of what's going on with Joseph's brothers while Joseph is in the pit and on his way to Egypt. Well, finally, Joseph is brought to Egypt. He then is there, obviously, for a reason, because he saves Egypt by the dream, the vision that the Lord gives to the ones in Egypt that only Joseph can interpret. By the way, there's a ton of interesting parallels between Joseph and what would happen with Daniel later, being brought into a foreign land, being the only one who can interpret the dreams that would eventually lead to the saving of the people in the land. Again, probably not accidental. It's kind of like Daniel probably read Genesis and said, "Hey, this matches. Let's make it match." Yeah, kind of. All the same plot. And then the brothers have to go to Egypt because there's a famine in the land. Okay, so that sounds like what happened with Abraham, right? Abraham had to go to Egypt, or thought he had to go to Egypt, because there's a famine in the land. Now the brothers go to Egypt because there's a famine in the land. And it's there that Joseph tests his brothers. And when they pass the test, he reveals himself to them. So the whole family comes down into Egypt. He's a savior not just for Egypt, but for his family. just as Joseph was brought under, brought in as a slave in Egypt, now it's like all of Egypt is a servant to Joseph. So there's a reversal there. And then you, again, going back, if you're like, okay, why is Judah positioned where he is? Well, it matches with Judah being receiving the blessing of Genesis 49. So we said that the end of Genesis is not really about Judah, but Judah is significant enough there that he's the one who receives the blessing of 49:8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. If I understand the wording in Hebrew there, that neck is probably not as clear of a translation. It would actually be something like head of your enemies, which would harken back to Genesis 3, the head of the serpent being crushed. Like, it's like the Lord is telling Judah, you will crush the head of your enemies. Just like Eve was told, your offspring will crush the head of the serpent. But Judah receives that blessing there. Joseph, in fact, mourns the death of Joseph, of Jacob, his father, whereas previously Jacob had mourned what he thought was the death of his son. And then Joseph at the end, it's like his dream is fulfilled. He does provide for his brothers. His brothers do serve him before he dies. There's also an interesting reversal of what happens in Genesis 4, where, you know, in Genesis 4 you have the one brother who was offended by his brother and killed him. Now you have Joseph who's offended by his brothers and forgives them. So there's parallels there as well. There's also, and we don't have time to, there's tons more we could say, but even just some of the details, but I'm thinking even the relation of the relationships of brothers in Genesis is interesting. It's the younger son Abel who is accepted rather than Cain. It's the younger son Jacob who receives the birthright and blessing rather than Esau. It's the younger son Isaac who continues the promise rather than the older son Ishmael. Joseph again is not the youngest in his family, but he has 10 older brothers. And none of them get the attention that Joseph gets. So all kinds of interesting things. Again, showing that God despises the wisdom of the world, makes the wisdom of the world look foolish, and makes the foolishness of man look wise, as Paul says in Corinthians. So, all right. That's enough for me. Like always, I hope this is helpful. I hope, hope as you read your Bibles, read Genesis, maybe could see some of these flows of thought that I think I mentioned, a couple weeks ago again in here. Like, I'm convinced Moses wrote this. I think this is, Jesus said Moses wrote the Pentateuch. That seems to make a lot more sense to me than what other scholars might try to tell us, but. And I think Moses was pretty good at giving us the history of what actually happened, but telling it in a creative and memorable way and doing it faithfully. So, happy to talk, answer questions, discuss, debate, if need be. But let's pray first, and that way those who don't care to do such things can move on. Lord, again, we give thanks to you for your word, for the chance to think about it, talk through it, and I pray be wowed by you, the way that you work through people, through unexpected people. Lord, I pray we would align ourselves with the seed of the woman, with the Lord Jesus, who came to crush the head of the serpent through his death on the cross and subsequent resurrection, that we might have life in you and in him, to triumph over the evils that we face in our lives as well. So go with us from here. Help us to continually search your scriptures, to see you in them, and to walk